You're listening to AFM Radio on astronomy.fm, around the world and beyond.
Arr. Coming up next, it's time for an AFM Radio original program, Space Pirate Radio, brought to you by the Voice of Astronomy MIDI. This is astronomy.fm.
The pirates are coming, the pirates are coming, the pirates are coming, you better watch out.
Arr. It's Space Pirate Radio Times, Buckos, here on astronomy.fm. That means it is another Wednesday evening, and this one is May the 10th, 2017, 9 o'clock in the evening for me in the eastern portion of North America, also known as 1 o'clock in the morning, May the 11th, 2017, at 1 o'clock in the morning, Universal Time. So that means I am live tonight. My co-host Diane, not feeling well, so she's bowed out. So that means I'm going to need some help from the chat room to keep things going here, keep me up to date. So remember, our chat room is open, and you can join me at astronomy.fm/chat, or go to the homepage and find the chat room. And feel free to log in, type in a name, and join me reading the chat as much as I can throughout the evening. I'll look at your what you type in there and see if I can answer any of your questions on air. I'd be more than happy to do that. Consider you part of the Space Pirate crew when you join our chat room Wednesday evening. So far we got me and Richie and Sky Guy Nick and Glenn, Black Project, Plaid Mac, Evil Spock in chat room so far. I know, it's getting a little, here in the Northern Hemisphere, it's getting a little later, a little later, so it's getting hard to remember to come on inside, it's still light out, come on and join Space Pirate Radio. Well, let's see where we're going to start. We'll start out with the sun. The sun is blank. No spots at all. In fact, I think we've had, so far this year, we've registered about 30 days with no sunspots. So, and, you know, that's just for the first 4 or 5 months. Last year was like 30 days for the entire year with no spots. And right now, 30 days for into 5 months. That means there's probably going to be a lot more spotless days on the suns. Nothing too interesting to see in white light anyways. But switch over to ultraviolet light. Looks like there is a bit of a coronal hole starting to rotate towards our direction, and that usually means particles will be streaming out of that coronal hole. There's no inner atmosphere to hold an outer atmosphere to hold those particles down from the surface of the sun. So they stream out a little bit more actively and will be hitting there. In fact, they're expecting some activity tonight, actually. So those of you just getting into some darkness, check out and keep a close eye out for some aurora, northern or southern, somewhere near the poles and magnetic poles especially. So keep an eye out. Maybe you'll see a little bit of something. Like I saw some reports yesterday of a little bit of activity showing in hydrogen alpha light. So if you have that special filter for your telescope, there was a rather impressive short-lived prominence on the sun yesterday. Looked like there's a bit of an active region on the edge of the sun right now, the western edge of the sun. So that might show a little bit with a hydrogen alpha telescope. So give that a shot. Check it out. Otherwise, not very interesting. Solar wind speeds are down, kind of quiet, only 349 kilometers per second for the winds coming off the sun, and that's actually considered pretty low. Particle density is up a little bit, so there's some stuff coming from the sun. The density is at 8.47 protons per cubic centimeter. That's moderately elevated, so that's what's going to give us a little bit of potential coronal activity, auroral activity around the pole. So check that out. If you got some clear skies, you can get some views in. Unfortunately, though, clear skies with a full moon don't really go together very well. So, well, the moon's going to be hanging around the equator. So kind of not too bad if you're living near the poles and get some auroral activity with the moon, full moon in the opposite direction. So you might still get something. Check it out and see if you do, and let us know. I haven't seen any auroral activity this entire solar maximum seasons. Just never seemed to look out that way with a little bit of bad weather and timing and stuff like that. give you a little rundown of what's happening with some planets, the moon in the sky. So, again, we got full moon tonight. Let's see. Saturday night, we got Saturn will be 3 degrees south of the moon. And next Wednesday, Mercury will be at greatest western elongation. That means Mercury is west of the sun, so the best time to see it would be just before sunrise. For northern hemisphere observers, not a very good chance of seeing it because the ecliptic lies rather low this time of year at sunset. So Mercury hovers also kind of low towards the southeastern horizon. So a bit more of a challenge to be able to see Mercury in the evening just before the sunrise. Southern hemisphere observers will get a much better chance to see it. So see if you can see it next Wednesday. It'll be 26 degrees away from the sun. And as I always recommend, look for Mercury during the daytime. You know? Nice separation, less chance of getting your scope a little too close to the sun, accidentally you're getting too much glare. But it's always best if you kind of put your telescope in the shade and then look for Mercury. So if you scan a little too far to the east, then you won't accidentally get into the sun if you're using the shade of a building to block out sunlight, but still allow you to actually see where Mercury's at and its shape. It should be somewhere around sort of halfway lit up, something like that. And that's it for this week. Next week, a little bit more activity with the moon and planets and stuff like that, but this week, nothing too special along that way. We got Twisted John in our chat room just now, so welcome, John. Good to see you again. Let's see. All right. We're kind of scanning around things. If you've got some topics you want to go through, let me know. I'll type them in the chat room and see where we go. I got a couple for us to ponder. Looking at some near-Earth asteroids. Nothing really spectacular. Let's see. Coming up on, May the 29th. And June the 1st, some kind of big ones, about 1,500 feet in diameter. Both of them are pretty much about the same size, but they're going to be about 2 million miles away from the Earth. So kind of far away, even though they're fairly sizable, but too far away, so probably won't get any views of those. Everything else, May the 12th, got one about 120 feet. That's about the same distance. 2 million miles. Another one on the 11th, 2 million miles away. It's only 60 feet. So nothing very impressive as far as close asteroids coming up in the near future. So sometimes, though, things appear on the list after they've actually gone by. The reason for that is because they can come from the general direction of the sun. So that means that the far side of these asteroids are lit up. We see the dark side of them, which means we don't see them. And then when they pass by, they go under a nighttime sky, and the face side of the asteroid that's facing towards us is lit up, and then we can see them. So something could be flying by at any time, but we don't notice it sometimes until after it's actually flown by, get sunlight on it in our nighttime sky. Let's see. We got a note from Art. Mercury, Iceland loses its aurora on the 20th this month for 2 to 3 months. Yeah, the farther north you get to in the northern hemisphere, we're going to start losing nighttime. So, question from Glenn. Dark side? Well, yeah, there's a dark side of an asteroid and a bright side of an asteroid. We are tidally locked. What are we tidally? Not to asteroids. They can be, well, even if we were tidally locked so that one side of an asteroid always faced towards us, but the thing flies by us, so part of it would be lit up and part of it would be dark, and we're not tidally locked to any of the asteroids that fly by anyways. Well, as I was saying, yeah, the northern hemisphere is increasing in daytime, losing its nighttime. Southern hemisphere, just the opposite. So the farther north you get where you could potentially see some aurora, we're also starting to lose nighttime, so it narrows the window down of when we could actually see some aurora, because it might be there, but just in daylight time. Let's see. All right, Glenn says, could it be? No, in order to be tidally locked, you generally have to have something in a regular orbit. So, for instance, the moon is tidally locked to the Earth. Now, I think that, if I'm not mistaken, it's Venus and the Earth are more like in resonance, so that we would see the same side of Venus when we're at closest. But that's just because of the way the planet Venus goes around the sun and the Earth goes around the sun. So when they're closest, they would, you know, basically be the same side. But we can't see the surface of Venus anyway, so kind of a moot point. So you can get a resonance where two sides of something would always point towards us, but if it's an orbit around something, it would not be tidally locked to us. A little bit different terms on tidally locked in resonance there. All right, so a little bit of a couple of things I've been seeing on Facebook. Some of those things that those like anti-science or misconceptions in science and things like that. Here's an article. I saw one. It was, listen to this one carefully. Life on other planets. NASA's Cassini finds evidence of life on Saturn's moons. Let me put this article into our chat room. You can read this. Read the misspelling, which is prominent throughout the entire article. Cassini. Something Cassini sounds kind of familiar. Where have I heard the phrase Cassini before? I don't know. Well, anyways, yeah, they mispronounce the word Cassini, which is the name of the space probe that's orbiting Saturn right now. And it did not find evidence for life on any of Saturn's moons. And then it kind of gets a little bit better into the article about, talking about what do they call that life that could potentially live in extremophiles. So they talk a little bit about extremophiles. They're not saying the more the article and you get into it, says they're definitely not life discovered on any of the moons or anything like that. But it does talk about, you know, finding the types of things that could support life, and then they screw it up saying one of the main things that will support life is hydrogen. It's like, no. Well, let's see if I can find that part of the article and quote it a little bit, but no. Hydrogen is the most abundant element in the universe, and it's not the main thing that supports life, okay, because there's not life scattered throughout the entire universe because of hydrogen. There's plenty of hydrogen on the sun. There's no life there. All the planets are that way. Plenty of hydrogen on all the stars. Plenty of hydrogen on all the stars. That does not mean there's potential of life there. Not in the least bit. So they screwed that one up. I don't know if they're trying to talk about something else or what, but you got to read the article yourself. Yeah. Cassini. Oh, here we go. Cassini has discovered that hydrogen exists on two of Saturn's moons, Rhea and Titan. According to NASA scientists, hydrogen has the potential to act as a chemical source of energy and could support microbial life. No. A lot of misquoting NASA. So, yeah, a lot of articles, they don't know enough science. When they read a little bit from NASA and then misinterpret it and misspell it, and then throw it out there as, you know, quoting NASA. Once in a while, this stuff pops up on Facebook in interesting different ways, too. That's just one of the past articles this week. Another one was on astrology. This one's come up before, kind of got reposted, about how astrologers are mad at NASA because they just made a 13th constellation of the zodiac. It's like, no, not even close. No. I looked it up. The constellations were actually formalized back in 1922 by the International Astronomical Union. They made up the boundaries, the official boundaries for the constellations, kind of a worldwide agreement, so that basically when scientists talk about stuff in the sky and its coordinates and things like that, they can all agree on the same coordinates and look up that same spot and find the same object, and everybody can do their own separate research and stuff like that on objects. But they had to define the actual boundaries of the constellations, and those were officially designated in 1922. Before that point, different cultures obviously did and still do have their own constellations. And different, you know, names for star constellations and stuff like that. Let me backtrack a little bit. A constellation is starting out generally an area of sky where you see some stars, a pattern of stars. And long, long time ago, thousands of years ago, people kind of used the stars to a way to remembering those star patterns was say, hey, that looks like something that we're familiar with, like, for instance, part of our mythology. So that looks like one of our characters in mythology. So we'll call that pattern of stars Orion, for instance, a character in mythology. So everybody in their culture said it looked like one of their story characters, so everybody called it Orion. Well, other cultures around other parts of the world that did not communicate with them said, no, it looks like something else. And they called it a different name. And different cultures throughout the world do the same thing too. And some patterns even to us look like similar things, but not similar things. Like, for instance, the Big Dipper, we see it as a kind of a pan or ladle, hence the name Big Dipper. But in the UK area, it was referred to as a plow. That does look like a plow that would be drawn behind an animal and push the soil and till the soil. And then other cultures said, got a little bit more detailed and said, this is a big bear. That's Ursa Major, where the Big Dipper is just what's considered an asterism, a group of stars within a constellation. And there's some kind of crossover ones too, like Pegasus and Andromeda. The Great Square of Pegasus, four stars that form a pretty big square, and one star that forms Andromeda is actually the same star. So basically, two constellations share the same star. So it gets a little confusing. Now, as scientists started studying the stars, started cataloging the stars, recording the stars, making star charts, there was some blank spaces in between the bright stars. Okay, which little star, now after you get the major stars, what little star belongs to that constellation? Does it belong to the one in the east? Does it belong to the one in the west? So they've made some boundaries. So officially, a constellation is not just that bright pattern of stars that originally reminded somebody of something familiar, but they made kind of uneven but permanently designated boundaries for the stars, and all the stars, no matter how faint they are considered part of that constellation. So there's obviously more stars that are fainter and harder to see in every constellation than the brighter stars. It's just a lot more dimmer stars, just the nature of the way the stars are. And I said, and then back in 1922, they made official boundaries and said, okay, these are the actual designated boundaries of the constellations. Now, when they did that, it put 13 constellations into the ecliptic. Yeah. The sun goes through 13 boundaries. You know, if they wanted to, they could change those boundaries and say, okay, some of the stars are Ophiuchus. They're not in Ophiuchus. They're in Scorpius or Sagittarius. They could have changed that if they want to, but nope. They decided to make boundaries just the way they did for easier designations. Now, astrology, I don't want to get in too much of astrology, but just a little bit. I looked it up and some things were a little confusing on it. So from what I could tell, a couple of different ways of doing the constellations of the zodiac that the sun goes in. Some designations are the constellations of the zodiac have equal boundaries. So they all take up an equal amount of space, and each space was given a designation. Whether the bright stars that you see in the sky fit those designations didn't seem to matter one way or the other. So they just basically said, okay, the sky is perfect. We have to divide the ecliptic perfectly, even all the way around. And no matter what the stars look like, we're just going to make them perfectly even. And then they kind of had a starting point. And then it's kind of like a clock that doesn't quite run on time. So after a while, they noticed that the sun was in not in the same part of the constellation. It was drifting, so that after a couple thousand years, the sun on a specific date was actually in a different constellation. Yeah, so when your clock is not running right, it's hard to keep time that way unless you kind of fudge things around. So didn't know that, you know, the Earth doesn't, you know, go around the sun that evenly, and the constellations kind of drift a little bit. It's called precession. The wobble of the Earth's pole swivels around a little bit. It takes a long time. It takes 26,000 years for the Earth's pole to swivel around, but that affects the position of the constellations. So you have a non-perfect sky, and trying to get a perfect astrological system to match it didn't quite work. So, for instance, the starting point of the year was kind of drifted from one constellation to another constellation. And then people also noticed that some constellations are wider. When you look at the star patterns themselves, some of them are wider than others, and some of them are narrower than others. So if we made them all equally spaced, you know, some constellations are going to be halfway into another constellation. That really messes up the design. So people were starting to, you know, look at the size of the constellations. Well, this doesn't match. Some are bigger, some are smaller. We can't make them all even because that really screws things up. So they kind of made them bigger and smaller. And then you weren't getting perfect months for the year, and things were getting scrambled up that way too. So yeah, it went on and on. And I was reading something about, yeah, different ways of designating the constellation. And I said, like, and then when they made the official boundaries, it actually put, you know, 13 constellations that the sun actually goes through. Black Projects in our chat room says, this is the reason astrology is a load of hogwash. Yeah, that doesn't even get into if you want to call it religious aspect of astrology, that just because the sun is facing towards a group of stars that one culture designates it with this characteristic and another culture designates it with another characteristic, and this one designates it with a characteristic. So that's where astrology breaks down on several reasons. Like, not only is the sun into a different constellation, constellations are not all that even, and the sky is not that even, and the Earth is not perfect, the sun is not perfect, and the way everything goes around each other is not perfect. So looking for perfection in the stars doesn't work at all, and hasn't worked. But they still put, you know, astrology in the newspapers more than they do astronomy. You can see your daily horoscope, which if you took the horoscope in a paper and you cut them out, took the names off of them, scrambled around and handed one to somebody and tell them this is their horoscope and handed them like to a bunch of different people one day, and then you could take those same, you know, horoscopes, give everybody a different one the next day, and everybody a different one the next day, they would all pretty much agree with the predictions. Yeah, it's all made up. What was that? What they used to one TV show. It's all made up, and the points don't count anyways. So that's astrology for you. Basically, it's just made up for fun. Or whatever way you want to interpret it. So, all right, let's see what else we got here. We already went through what the moon and the planets were. Yeah, let's see. Right, let me check on any notes here. What is today? Lost Sock Day? Somebody, our radio director, described it as Lost Sock Day. Official designation, I guess. Makes you kind of wonder. Now, I can imagine if there's all these lost socks out there, is there any way that they could, like, reanimate and pop up and attack everybody? Makes you think about that one. Kind of like Night of the Living Dead type of thing. All right. Here's something that came up a few days ago from the American Association of Variable Star Observers. They have different notices that they publish when scientists need certain stars monitored for professional researchers. They constantly publish things. Okay, go look at this star and report your observations to them. So that'll help astronomers understand usually like variable stars and binary stars and things like that. Here's a solar observing guide published by the AAVSO. This was just a few days ago, I think in March or May the 2nd, something like that. Let me put that into our chat room. I recommend downloading, keeping it, and reading it. Let me put it into, where's our chat room? Here we go. There you go. Check this out. Solar Observing Guide, free from the American Association of Variable Star Observers. Check that out. Something that I know I'm old school. I would rather print it and keep it with me instead of doing it in electronic form. We'll start in electronic form and then print it out. Here's a table of contents, by the way. Introduction, purpose, cautionary notes, of course, observing the sun. Section 3, methods of observing the sun. 4, equipment. 5, observations and recording guidelines and notes. 6, reporting observations. And 7, resources with the appendices on seeing conditions, the Zurich classification system, a Macintosh classification system, and the orientation and finding the equator of the suns. So geared towards solar observers for the American Association of Variable Star Observers, recording your observations and then turning them into the AAVSO, kind of on that. But there's a whole guide for that. So it's nice when they print out things like this for free. Let's see. Well, we're kind of getting close to our halfway point. Should we go to our halfway point now? Yeah. All right, one more article before the halfway point. This one's come out from a couple different sources. A picture of the Crab Nebula combined with images taken from several satellites and observatories, Hubble, VLA, Chandra, Spitzer, and the XMM Newton combined data create a new image of the Crab Nebula. And I think this image is really interesting. I've seen everybody's seen Crab Nebula pictures for a long time. Different wavelengths of light will show different features, different colors, more structure, less structure, outer structure, inner structure, stuff like that. But this one, what I find interesting is the area around the pulsar in the middle is showing like a donut spiral, and it looks like a jet coming out of it. I've never seen that in any other image of the Crab Nebula before. Let's see, where's this one? I've got this one. It's in the Hubble website, or the NASA website. It's also in SciTech Daily, right on their homepage too. So check out the latest image of the Crab Nebula in Taurus the Bull, which is not visible right now. But look to that inner circle with a jet coming out of it. I think that's really a neat picture of Crab Nebula that we haven't seen before. All right, about halfway through our program, so we'll do a little station identification. You are... Oh, waiting for that other R didn't come out. You are listening to Space Pirate Radio here on astronomy.fm. It is Wednesday evening, and this one happens to be May the 10th, 2017, 9:30 in the evening for me here in the eastern portion of North America. So universal time, that would put it at Thursday morning, May the 11th, 2017, at 1:30 in the morning. So we're halfway through our program. Hope you've been listening in. Now, if you missed the first half, don't forget we're going to repeat this program every 4 hours for the next 24 hours. And, of course, coming up, our usual lineup of programming, including Astronomy Ireland, Naked Astronomers, Naked Astronauts, and Planetary Radio, all coming up after Space Pirate Radio. So tune in after the show. My co-host, Diane, not with me tonight, not feeling well. So it's just you and me in the chat room. On with the show. If you've got any questions for me or topic ideas you want to throw out there, we can talk a little bit about other topics too. If you come up with something that you've been interested in, or something that I started on in one of our astronomy clubs, it was ask a stupid question. And the premise to that was there is no stupid question. The only stupid question is the one that you don't ask. So if you're listening in and you've got this burning question about astronomy that you've always wanted to know, but you thought, well, no, somebody's going to laugh at me if I ask this question. No, ask the question. And then hopefully we'll give you an answer. And that's the best way to learn about things that you're not familiar with by actually asking it. And this is the time to do it right after our break time. So right now, if you got something, or I'll come back to the chat room at about another designated time, like quarter to, something like that, or 45 after. So if you got another question, write it down, and then I'll let you know, and you can do a little copy and paste and pop it in the chat room where I can reach it, and we'll get you through your question. So any question on astronomy that you wanted to ask but you thought, yeah, it's too simple, it's not too simple, just ask the question. All right, here's an article from NASA's New Star. This one's kind of cool. It's about merging black holes and merging galaxies. So we're all kind of familiar with a little bit of galaxies colliding together, like the Andromeda Galaxy and the Milky Way Galaxy are going to be colliding in so many billions of years from now. And when galaxies collide, the black holes won't usually directly collide. It's almost impossible to get a direct collision. But they can kind of come close to each other and orbit around each other. And definitely a lot of swirling and churning happens when galaxies collide. Now, when galaxies collide, sometimes the first pass will be a near miss. They'll swing out around and then start getting back to each other. Depending on the stage of collision will determine what happens in the black hole of each of the galaxies. You know, everybody kind of familiar with material spiraling around a galaxy in a donut shape. When you get to the final closer end stages of galaxy merging, turns out that the black hole in the galaxies don't have a spiral of gas and stars going around them. They seem to be surrounded by a ball or shell of gas and stars around the black hole. So the gas, as the two galaxies start to collide, the gas gets surrounding the black holes, makes like a cocoon of material. And when other things pass by, clumps, stars, things like that will pass by that collapse, by that cloud, it can actually start to throw some of the gas and dust into the black hole. And that's when you get the black hole basically lighting up. The particles near the black hole speed up, collide together. They give off gamma rays. They become noticeable, gamma rays and X-rays. So you have a lot more activity in the centers of galaxies when they're kind of near total collision, because the gas is all crashing into them, each other, from all different directions. So as compared to a spiral, when the gas is basically all spiraling around in the same direction, you just get stuff kind of staying in orbit, and it doesn't leave the orbit. It'll actually stay in a pretty stable orbit until something else kind of crashes into that gas and starts throwing it towards the center of the black hole. So, and that's generally in a disk pattern for just a regular galaxy. If we can get two of them colliding together, the stuff is coming in from all directions, and then you have a lot more activity. Here's a post for that article. Let's see. Let me think. Prove there was moon landings. Okay. The challenge question from Nick. Prove there was moon landings. Well, few ways of proving the landings, sort of, with a little bit of faith too, I guess. People witnessed the actual launch of the rockets. From that point on, you'd have to just assume the rockets made it all the way to the moon. But if you want to have proof that they made it to the moon and back, and the best way would be with the lunar rock samples and dust samples that was brought back from the moon that were distributed to scientists all around the Earth, not just American scientists, but scientists from all around the world that analyzed the rock particles. And they could determine that, yes, these particles actually came from the moon. And when all the scientists from around the world agree on this, on the same analysis, that would be the main proof that, yes, the particles came back from the moon, because astronauts actually went to the moon to bring them back. And you can tell that by analysis, like these types of rocks were never, ever on the Earth itself. So that would be, I guess, the best way of proving that there were people landed on the moon. Well, at least, if you want to get to it, robots on the moon that brought the stuff back. So at least people created machines that went to the moon and brought stuff back. But there were cameras on the moon. So that would be the best proof. I know some people, the disclaimers, were talking about how the moon pictures, the moon pictures from taken from the surface of the moon, like fake. Well, it's like you just don't understand enough science, and that's why you'd say that. A lot of ways of proving that people were on the moon. Oh, let's see. Get back to some of the articles in NASA were pretty interesting. Oh, I've got a June 1st, going to be a launch of a SpaceX cargo mission to the International Space Station. So that's Thursday, June 1st. Again, that's a time when I like to go to heavens above and see if I can actually see the space station flying over me and being able to actually see the cargo ship not attached to the space station. So that'll be another opportunity coming up for that June the 1st, which I thought I've never been able – I've seen it with the space shuttle and the space station flying close together, but have not seen it with any of the Soyuz or any of the cargo ships flying close together. So another thing to give a shot and try. Let's see. Journey to Mars testing prepares NASA's space launch system for liftoff. So everybody's kind of got the buzz about going to Mars. Still those issues of, you know, radiation zapping the people. I'm starting to think now that maybe it would not be a matter of shielding, but more of being able to resist the radiation. They're talking about some biology technology that would could handle the radiation. So if you get, you know, radioactively zapped, that if they develop the biology technology, that it would just basically just not affect your body, even if you do get, you know, dosed with a lot of radiation. So I think that might actually be developed before strong lightweight shielding that would prevent, you know, the astronauts from getting zapped. So that would certainly be an improvement, a lot better, because then they could use their regular spacesuits for walking down on the surface of Mars, for instance, and they wouldn't have to worry about getting sick from radiation sickness that way. So probably be a little easier system to develop instead of a lot of shield. Like a lot of people say, well, I'll just use a lot of water surrounding this, the spaceship. Well, yeah, that water, but the water eventually gets contaminated. Then where do you get more uncontaminated water? You can raise some issues that way. Let's see. Oh, yeah, stuff in the skies. Then we kind of get to what's up, and except for what are they going to talk about? Oh, well. The moon and planets. Are there still other planets to look at, like Mars? You know, Mars is still barely there. It's disappearing faster now, but it's still trailing the sun and still above the horizon just after the sun goes down. So a little bit of observing challenge for the planet Mars is how much longer than the rest of the year can you actually see Mars in our evening sky? So you might want to give that a shot, see if we can keep observing it. And even though it's really bad observations because Mars is kind of around the far side of the sun and really, really small, but still visible in our evening sky. It's been around for a couple of years, and then pretty soon it's going to go in the morning sky, and then it's going to start getting closer and closer, and then we'll be back to opposition again in another year or two, something like that. Still out there, though. And, of course, the main planet is Jupiter. Well up even before sunset. So, again, a little bit of observing challenge of trying to see Jupiter in the daylight, in the daytime, from northern hemisphere, southern hemisphere. Certainly possible to do that. And it doesn't take much for the skies to get dark now. And Jupiter's well-placed in the evening sky a little bit after the sun goes down. So I've seen lots of great observations on the internet by people photographing the planet Jupiter. So I think our own Mark chat room has been taking pictures, a lot of great pictures of the moon too. So people are really getting out there and doing some astrophotography. And the images are really, really well. Because when just think about it, if you look through a telescope at Jupiter, it's actually pretty small. And you can see some detail on the planet, but the more detail, depending on your sky conditions, appears at lower magnification. So if you use lower magnification to see more detail, it makes the planet pretty small. And if you try to crank up the power to see a bigger planet, you start to lose some detail. So there's kind of a balance between how much you magnify it and how much detail you can see on it. And it really depends a lot on your observing conditions too, and the telescope, where the telescope's located, all kinds of stuff like that. And then taking pictures makes it even tougher also. So you have to get really a good camera, some good sky conditions, a good telescope, be able to pull that detail out of Jupiter, and then processing after that too. So it is a bit of a challenge, but it is being done. I've seen some pretty spectacular images of the planets lately, like Jupiter and the moon, of course, too. So, which you think would actually be easy, but if you really try looking at the moon and seeing how much detail, you'll notice that the detail really flutters in and out because of the atmosphere. So it is actually hard to get a good image of the moon unless you combine video frames. So when you've got some good steady air, you capture the frame. When it's fuzzy, even though you've captured it, you can throw that frame out, so get rid of the fuzzy pictures and combine all the good pictures. If you're looking at the moon, I've noticed that you can see ripples of atmosphere going across the moon. Not from the moon, from the Earth, but you can see them going across. So one side of the moon will be relatively clear and the other side will be kind of fuzzy. So if you take one quick snapshot, yeah, you're going to have half the moon that's fuzzy. So you have to kind of combine pictures of different clear spots and combine them all together to make the whole moon clear. And then there's different times of the night we can actually take photographs of the moon. So you're going to get it in different phases, and that affects your viewing. So obviously a full moon, not a good time for seeing a lot of detail on the moon. But when the moon's halfway lit up, You get really great contrast and shadows along the Terminator, that line between light and dark. But you lose half the planet, for instance, if it's first quarter or last quarter, because that's in dark. So you might have nice sharp craters along the Terminator. The other half of the moon's dark. You don't get to see any, and the other side's all washed out. So you can combine different nights when the Terminator actually moves across the moon, so you can come up with different ways of observing techniques on craters and things like that. You can also shoot craters before the full moon and then after the full moon, so that the light coming in from the east side of a crater or the west side of the crater, and combine those images together and get the best view of the crater that way too. So, and some features come out at different times like that too. Some features on the moon call the Alpine Valley, I think, is best visible around first quarter. And the Straight Wall is a cliff on the moon. That's generally best visible before first quarter. And one called the Lunar X, which I've never actually seen. Another feature that I have to go try and see if I can see that feature on the moon. Also tried a little bit of observing the smallest possible feature on the moon too. That's a bit of a challenge. Okay, somebody said they lost me. Am I anybody else lose me? You still got me out there, everybody? Still listening to me? Hope so. Looking for the smallest crater on the moon was one challenge I did. And again, that's a thing you have to have really steady skies. Oh, thanks, Glenn. Glenn still hears me. John still hears me. Okay. So hopefully Plaid Mac will get me back. So the steadier the skies, the more magnification you use, and the moon's a pretty good test of that. I did it one time. I had some really incredibly steady skies, and I was able to just barely pick up on the smallest crater I could possibly see. It looked like a black dot in a white background. And I measured that crater, looked it up on a chart, found out it was 3 miles in diameter. And I think I probably had like 400 power through my telescope. So almost maxed out. So that give you an idea of how much you can see and how much you can't see on the moon. And that was a challenge. So give it a shot and let me know how small of a crater you've actually seen on the moon. And we'll compare notes on that. I need to do that again. And some other features too. When you really start looking at the moon, incredible amounts of details start coming off here. I've seen people start sketching the moon and say, oh, that looks pretty easy. Then you go, you know, look at it, and then you start seeing detail and more detail, not just craters, but rills, basically valleys going across the moon and different tones. You got light areas and dark areas, and you find that the pattern is on the moon is really, really detailed. And trying to draw it is kind of like trying to draw a tree, which you think, it's easy to draw a tree, trunk, branches, and a cap full of leaves. But then you start looking, it's like, oh, I could see individual leaves. And then if you zoom in on the leaves, you go, oh, now we see detail in every leaf. So try drawing 1,000 individual leaves, and you'll find out, yeah, it's actually hard to really draw a tree if you get into more detail. And same thing with the moon. Hard to get into a lot of detail that way. Interesting article about Comet 67P making its own oxygen gas. Let me put that link into our chat room for you. There we go. Coming up. All right, here we go. Comet 67P, Churyumov-Gerasimenko. Oh, I got through that one. Bet you didn't think I could do that, huh? There's a Caltech chemical engineer professor uses laboratory research to explain 67P's oxygen atmosphere. Kind of rare to have oxygen in space. because it tends to want to combine with other particles, and basically, so it kind of disappears, basically turns into other stuff. But they found out 67P is giving off some oxygen. And what's that about? Well, it's actually a bit of chemical reaction from particles from the sun bombarding the comet, and kind of, I think it's, if I'm not mistaken, it's kind of ionizing some of the gases on there, and that's what's allowing it to basically outgas some pure oxygen, molecular oxygen. That seems to be how that's actually working. Always interesting, and more data coming out of missions that are over, almost over. Jupiter. Jupiter, I forgot about Jupiter's moons too. So don't forget to check out a website called Project Pluto. It lists all of what's happening with Jupiter and its moons every day. So where we got here? May the 10th. Oh, let me look it up here. May the 10th on the list, and we'll see if anything's happening. Well, let's see. May the 10th at 0333 hours. So that would be 8:30 tonight. No, yesterday. So there was an eclipse started, and then a couple hours later, eclipse ended. So that was then the third moon. So that was Ganymede. So a Ganymede popped into the shadow of Jupiter, and then 2 hours and 20 minutes later, Ganymede popped out of the shadow of Jupiter. And all kinds of events like that happening with Jupiter's moons. So you don't always see all four moons next to Jupiter when you look at it. So sometimes one moon is like this inside of Jupiter's shadow. Sometimes the moon is behind it. Sometimes the moon is in front of it. Sometimes you can actually see a shadow of one of the moons in front of Jupiter. Makes it a little bit more interesting. So keep checking those charts of what's going to happen when you go out observing planet Jupiter. And my favorite one also is to check out when the fourth moon will be due north or due south of Jupiter, Callisto, that is. So I went go to intheSky.org under charts and come down to the moons of Jupiter. It gives kind of a quick view of what moon is on which side, east or west side of the planet Jupiter. Don't forget your telescope. If you have use it with a diagonal, it could be reversed left and right. So, and if you're using a Newtonian, it could be a little bit sideways. So it could be, you know, look like they're running up and down instead of side to side. So you have to kind of correct for it. This chart will also be able to allow you to tell you when the moon is in front, or I should say the moon is due north of Jupiter or due south of Jupiter by following the blue line. So I use both of them for that. Oh, let's see. We've got a little bit of time. Let's go back to our chat room. And, all right, everybody, let's see if you got any questions saved up for me on astronomy. So copy and paste, pop them in the chat room. We can see what we do. Oh, yeah, Nick's getting an all-sky camera. That's going to be pretty cool. Get some pretty good views from all sky cameras. All sky cameras are a camera that basically points straight up and gives you almost 180 degree view in every direction, depending on the camera system and stuff like that. So it gives you a very, very wide angle view of the sky. So you can actually see clouds rolling in from one side. It's kind of interesting at nighttime, the clouds are partially lit up. You can actually watch, take time-lapse video. You can see the clouds rolling through the nighttime sky. Get some interesting stuff like that. Again, time-lapse video, you can see satellites going over. You can capture shooting stars through an all-sky camera. And the sun will not burn out an all-sky camera, even though basically that chip is pointing up. The angle of the lens is so wide that it makes a really small image of the sun, and it doesn't heat up the chip and burn through it. So, yes, you can use the all-sky camera during the daytime. You don't have to cover it up. Don't have to shield it from the sun. One I used to like that's no longer around is one. It was in Perth Observatory down in Australia. They had an all-sky camera, and I was able to actually see much different skies than I'm used to here in the Northern Hemisphere. It was really cool to see the Milky Way going from horizon to horizon in an all-sky camera. The camera was quite sensitive enough at nighttime. We could get pick up the whole Milky Way galaxy that way and see the small Magellan clouds. And then as time went by, you know, they would basically show them in a different position. So all-sky camera in dark skies, really kind of cool. The one we had at museum didn't seem to work too well for me because there was so much light pollution that in the all-sky cameras, even though it was quote-unquote perfectly clear, the skies looked basically orange. Pretty much an even glow of orange. And it was almost, it was just, when it was cloudy, it was more orange. And then it was clear, it was less orange. So kind of not able to really see much detail through the all-sky camera. Kind of located a bit in a large city. So didn't really fulfill its purpose when you get it too close to the sea. So I think they really have to be outside in some dark skies. It's really cold during a meteor shower. But yeah, inside a city, large pollution, not very good. And then sometimes they're kind of oriented in strange ways where it's actually kind of hard to tell what direction you're looking in. And so, for instance, what was up on the monitor, you know, was not necessarily one designated direction. It's just a matter of how the camera happened to get oriented when it was put in. Pollution, Marty? Yes, pollution, Glenn. Light pollution. No, you can't get rid of light pollution with a BB gun. You can get rid of the lights, but you can't get rid of the junk that's above the lights, and that's the big problem. You need to get some really good skies without a whole lot of industrial areas, and that would be a good spot to put up an all-sky camera. I think there are still some websites, if I'm not mistaken, iTelescopes has some all-sky cameras set up around their observatory, so you can check those out. If anybody knows any sites of all-sky cameras where they put them up there, let me know, and we'll kind of check them out. Kind of fun seeing what the skies are like in different parts of the world using an all-sky camera. We've got about 3 minutes or a little less than 3 minutes. Anybody got anything to cover before we go? I always like to keep track of Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. Right now it's observing seasonal flows in Valles Marineris. That's a giant valley on Mars. So it actually shows some different changes depending on the season. So whether frost builds up or disappears, things like that. I kind of like the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter views of Mars, giving some pretty detailed images. It'd be fun to make a globe out of some of the detailed images of Mars. And of course, the problem would be, I guess, on, you know, if you made a globe, it'd still be kind of the whole planet, but it'd be kind of small images, so with good details when you really zoom in. So can you put some high-resolution, you know, photos on the globe, and so you can actually look at them with a microscope and see more detail that way? Yeah, maybe possible. It'd be kind of interesting to do it that way. I always wanted a good Mars globe. When they first started coming out, the $40, $50 Mars globes were just medium detail. Some people were actually making some fairly highly detailed ones. I know one guy that used to make one. He would actually carve valleys and craters and things like that into the globe. He was making large-sized ones, and I was going to buy one from him, and he was just kind of getting out of making those Mars globes when I wanted to buy one from him. So he didn't have any to sell, and he was going to make one more for me, but he never got around to it. So I wanted, it was going to be big, like 16 to 18 inches, too. It would have been a pretty nice one. Well, everyone, I guess it's time to head on out. We're almost at the end of our show. I want to thank everybody that's in our chat room tonight. Really appreciate you being here with me. Next week, Diane should be back, so we'll have a regular Space Pirate show next week. All right, everybody, I want to thank you for being here tonight. Don't forget, we'll repeat this program, and we'll see you all next week. Good night, everybody. Thanks again.
We hope that you've enjoyed this program from AFM Radio, the broadcast service of Astronomy.fm. This program has been released under Creative Commons license. Please contact us for details. You may find more of our AFM original programs on our website. It's really easy to find us. We are Astronomy.fm. You may also find us in the iTunes radio listings near the top of the News Talk section, and also as an iTunes podcast selection. We'd love to hear your comments. Please email us at radio@astronomy.fm. Thanks so much for being part of the voice of astronomy around the world and across the known universe. This is Astronomy.fm Radio.
AFM.